Welcome to Clinton First Ignited Methodist Church, and welcome to the Advent season. I'm not exactly sure how we got here, but here we are. Has it really been a year? It seems like we just did this, didn't we? We did it last year. Thank you, Abby. We just took all this stuff down and we put it back up. Actually, I was talking to Margie and Audrey and Sandy at the Cama breakfast yesterday, at the Advent breakfast, and we were talking, and it made the comment, it seems like maybe my calendar, the pages on my calendar get stuck together. And do you experience that? Like you've missed a whole month? It's like the calendar's stuck together, and I missed it. I miss whole blocks of time, I think, sometimes. Can you relate to that? Yeah. I think that's why we need this season of Advent. That's why Advent is so important to us, because the Advent season is a time of preparation. The word Advent simply means arrival. And in the case of Christmas, Advent marks the arrival of Christ, the greatest gift ever given. Advent then is a time for us to prepare our hearts for the arrival of Christ. And that's really my hope and prayer for this season of Advent, that your heart might be prepared for the arrival of Christ, that Christ might be born in your heart in a new way this Christmas. Don't you love this time of year? Don't you love the Christmas story? Now, just to clarify, I'm not talking about a Christmas story, the movie that depicts 9-year-old Ralphie's pursuit of the only thing he wants for Christmas, the ultimate gift, an official Red Ryder carbon action 200-shot range model air rifle with compass in the stock. Just to clarify, that's not what we're talking about. I'm talking about the Christmas story, the beautiful narrative from Matthew and Luke's Gospels, which we'll look at in just a minute. I'm talking about Joseph and Mary and the baby Jesus, the old little town of Bethlehem, the manger and the stable and all the animals. Don't you love the story of Christmas? Because while presents from Santa are nice, assuming you don't shoot your eye out, it's the presence of Christ that changes lives. Again, not the presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S, of Santa, but the presence, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E, of Christ that changes lives. He is present. God is always with us, always present. We are always on his mind. We are always in his heart. We are always in his plans. Matthew chapter 1, verse 23 reminds us of what the prophet Isaiah said. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. Not God made us, not God thinks of us, not even God near us, as in the vicinity or in the zip code, but God with us. Wherever you are, at work, at home, at school, in the kitchen, in your car, on a plane, although Matthew 28, Jesus specifically says, "And lo, I am with you always." I'm sorry, just kidding. And I really do need a pause, because there are some of you who will never step foot on a plane because of some of my sermon illustrations. And that's unfortunate. You need to know that God is with us. He became one of us. He breathed our air. He walked on our planet. They called him Emmanuel, which means God with us. God is with us. And we need that message more than ever, don't we? I mean, the world we live in is an anxious place. And in fact, we've spent quite a bit of time over the last few weeks talking about anxiety, haven't we? Remember Google's definition of anxiety? A feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome. Anxiety cripples us. It robs us. It takes our sleep. It takes our energy. It takes our well-being. Anxiety knots us up, doesn't it? Reminds me of another Christmas story. And if you've heard this, don't stop me, because I like to tell it. It seems that there was this little boy who was assigned the part of the angel for the annual Christmas pageant. And he and his mom ran over his lines over and over again. "It is I. Do not be afraid. It is I. Do not be afraid. It is I. Do not be afraid. It is I. Do not be afraid." But when he stepped out onto the stage and he saw the lights, he saw the crowded auditorium, He froze. He was all knotted up. And after a long, awkward silence, he whimpers, "It's me, and I'm afraid." Can you relate to that? It seems to be the prayer that I pray most often. Lord, it's me, and I'm afraid. But let me remind you of what Paul says in the passage we've spent several weeks looking at. This is from Philippians 4. Paul writes, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." Did you catch it? The phrase is hardly even noticeable, but the whole passage really kind of depends on that phrase. Verse 5, "The Lord is near." The Lord is near. God is with us. You are not alone. You're not left to fend for yourself. I realize there are times when you may feel like you're alone. There may even be times that you think that you're alone. But you need to know that there's never a time, never a place where God is not with you. There's never a moment in which you face life without help. Never a moment without Him. And God repeated that promise in Scripture, His presence to His people. Let me give you some examples. Genesis 15, verse 1, God tells Abram, "Do not be afraid. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." And then God reminded Isaac in Genesis 26, when he was driven away from his home by the Philistines and was being chased from place to place, he told him, "Do not be afraid, for I am with you." After Moses' death, God told Joshua in Joshua 1:9, "Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go." God was with David in spite of his adultery. God was with Jacob despite his conniving. God was with Elijah despite his lack of faith. And God is with you despite what you're struggling with, despite what you're going through. God is with you. And because God is with you, because the Lord is near, we can be anxious for nothing. That's Paul's whole point in this letter, isn't it? And please don't forget the fact that this is a letter. I don't know if you know it or not, but Paul didn't actually use chapter and verse numbers when he wrote this letter to the church of Philippi. This system of chapter and verse was created like in the 13th century. This system that we rely on can sometimes be a hindrance. And here's why I say that. "The Lord is near" is at the end of verse 5. "Do not be anxious about anything" is the beginning of verse 6. Makes it seem like these two are separate thoughts. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything. But if you take out the verse identifiers, if you read it the way Paul wrote it, he's actually saying, "The Lord is near, do not be anxious about anything." Or maybe, "The Lord is near, therefore, do not be anxious about anything." Or maybe better still, "The Lord is near, consequently, don't be anxious about anything." They will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. God is with us. Our passage this morning comes from Luke chapter 2, verses 1 to 7. Luke writes, "In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judah, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and the line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths, placed him in a manger, because there was no guest room available for them." Have you ever considered just the amazing way that God orchestrates events, how he works behind the scenes to bring things together, to make things happen? For instance, God ordained beforehand that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem, per the prophecy in Micah 5. But when the time came for the Messiah to be born, the Messiah's mother, Mary, and his legal father, Joseph, weren't living in Bethlehem. They lived in Nazareth. God then orchestrated things so that in order to fulfill his word, these two common people would be brought to Bethlehem that first Christmas. Isn't that amazing? God used Caesar Augustus, who, by the way, was not a believer, to help God accomplish his will. Now, you would think that if God so rules the world as to use an empire-wide census to bring Mary and Joseph to Bethlehem, that he could surely see to it that a room was available when they got there. Couldn't you? Wouldn't you think so? And before you ask, yes, he could have. For that matter, Jesus could have been born into a wealthy family. Jesus could have turned that stone into bread in the wilderness. Jesus could have called 10,000 angels to his aid at Gethsemane. And Jesus could have come down from the cross and saved himself. The question was never about what God could do, but about what God willed to do. God's will, according to 2 Corinthians 8, 9, was that though Christ was rich, yet for your sake he became poor. So the no vacancy signs that hung over all the motels in Bethlehem were for your sake. For your sake, he became poor. Make no mistake, God rules all things, even motel accommodations and capacities, for the sake of his children. Could it be that the splendor of Christmas is maybe the lack thereof on that first Christmas? The story of the birth of Christ just drips with normalcy, doesn't it? Mary and Joseph were just Mary and Joseph. They weren't Queen Mary. They weren't King Joseph. They obviously had no tax-exempt status, or they wouldn't have had to make the trip to Bethlehem in the first place. In fact, they didn't really have any status of any kind, did they? But isn't that the beauty of the story? I mean, that what if Jesus had decided to come into this world with pomp and circumstance, with all the flashing lights and the bands and all of that? Can you imagine? Imagine if Mary and Joseph had pulled into Bethlehem in a stretch limo. Well, if they'd been all decked out in designer clothes and jewelry. Imagine if the angels lined the red carpet all clamoring for an autograph or a picture, saying, "Oh, Mary, you look simply divine," which is a joke. Divine because Christ was in her. And I did all that to set it up. Jesus chose to be born to a normal, common, ordinary couple with normal, common, ordinary problems in a normal, common, ordinary place. Mary and Joseph were normal folk with normal, common problems just like us, just like me, just like you. God with us. God became one of us. And they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. God is with us. Let's take another look at the passage we use as our call to worship. This is John chapter 1, verses 1 to 5, and then I'll read verse 14. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And then verse 14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Dr. Warren Wiersbe of the Bible Exposition Commentary explains, Matthew wrote his fellow Jews with his fellow Jews in mind and emphasized that Jesus in Nazareth had fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies. Mark wrote to the busy Romans, whereas Matthew emphasized the king, Mark presented the servant ministering to the needy people. Luke wrote his gospel for the Greeks and introduced them to the sympathetic Son of Man. But it was given to John, the beloved disciple, to write a book for both Jews and Gentiles, presenting Jesus as the Son of God. And then Wiersbe goes on to say, whereas the first three Gospels major on describing events in the life of Christ, John emphasizes the meaning of these events. John then is able to present the meaning of the entire Christmas story in just one verse, verse 14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us.
We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Joseph, Mary, the baby Jesus, the little town of Bethlehem, the manger in the stable with all the animals, the angels and the shepherds, the star and the wise men. Those are all important details of the event as recorded in Matthew and Luke. But the meaning behind the story of Christmas, the meaning behind the event, is that the Word became flesh. And he dwelt among us. He made his dwelling among us. Jesus came, God in human flesh, to be heaven's voice for you to hear, to be heaven's presence for you to see. Jesus is the ultimate expression of the Father's heart. Jesus came as the Father's greatest message. And as Luke 2 tells us in Luke 2, 7, that message was wrapped in cloths and placed in a manger. He dwelt among us. God is here. God is with us. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. Jesus, God's one and only Son, became a man. He was God in the flesh. He was the visible expression of the invisible deity. God expressed himself through Christ in a language that we could understand. God identified with the frailties and the tragedies of the human race. God got up close and personal with us. In our passage, again, looking at verse 14, John used one word to embody this revelation of God. Theologians have written volumes of books to explain the doctrine of incarnation. But John sums it up in a single word, a single thought, dwelt. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. He dwelt among us. And I love Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of this verse in the Message. He writes, "The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood." Isaiah said, "And they will call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us. God is with us. On the night that he was betrayed, Christ met with his friends in the upper room, and he tried to prepare them for the events that were quickly coming, events that would end his life and forever change their lives. They came together to celebrate the Passover meal. And that meal represented the salvation of the Jewish people. And as you know, it was a very scripted meal. A meal where the youngest in the room would ask questions about what happened, which is part of what I love about Christmas, because at some point, someone asks the question, what is it about this baby? Why do we celebrate this season? That's part of the wonderment of Christmas. The beauty of Christmas is that it poses those questions. At the appropriate time in that script, Christ took the bread and he changed the script. He blessed it. And he broke it. And he offered it to his friends. He said, "This is my body broken for you. Take and eat of it, each of you. And as often as you do this in remembrance of me." Common, ordinary, normal bread. The body of Christ. Broken for you. And then at the appropriate time in the meal, he took the cup and he blessed it. And he offered it to his friends. He said, "This is the blood of a new covenant, my blood shed for many, poured out for many. Take and drink of it, each of you. And as often as you do this in remembrance of me." You need to know that here at First Church, we have an open table, which means everyone is welcome to take communion. We do this by intention, so you'll come up, you break off a piece of the bread, you dip it in the cup, and you partake. We've got a little box down here. The offering for this month will go to the Bishop's Children's Christmas offering. So as you come up, you're invited to and encouraged to drop something into that box. If you're not able to come to the front, please stay where you are. Audrey and I will come to you. Come as you're ready.